basics to it.
We're brave slaves out here on the perimeter. And today we discuss with Wendell Fitzgerald, one of our favourite interviewees over the last 3.5 years, all about the worth of the earth and some of the current issues travelling around inside of anyone into social justice. Welcome to the Renegade Economist with your host, Carl Fitzgerald. And yes, when I was lucky enough to visit America, I did interview Wendell Fitzgerald, and feedback from listeners has been that the first interview we did with Wendell was one of the best ever. And you can, if you want to check out some of the highlights of the best interviews we've done, go to earthsharing.org.au/radio and look at the drop-down list on the left-hand navigational panel, and you'll see radio interviews there. Click on that, and there are screeds of interviews. I haven't put many up from the last half of this year, though I really need to. Wendell Fitzgerald has just a nice, you know, fireside manner discussing some of these ugly issues of economics. So he is a longtime stalwart of geonomics or Georgist economics, and recently he's been the treasurer and campaigner for an independent candidate called Joyce Seegers for Congress in Oregon. So he's a busy man. He's just bringing us back to base on some of the core issues that we talk about on this show. And within the interview, there's a couple of different articles referred to. One is The Killer that Marika Dobbin released in, yes, you guessed it, The Age, called Melbourne Heads North to Kelkalo, which talks about the Burgess sisters whose father bought a property north on the Hume Highway for $920,000, a 1,100 hectare property, was recently sold for a $300 million windfall. So check out that Melbourne Heads North to Kelkalo, a rampant example of land banking if ever there was one. There's also reference to Terry Dwyer's report, The Taxable Capacity of Australian Land and Resources, from 2003. So sit back and have a listen to Mr. Wendell Fitzgerald as we discuss the ways of the world.
Can you sum up for us what geonomics is all about?
Geonomics is the economics of land. It's an incredible whole realm of economic understanding, without which, in my opinion, it's impossible to understand what's going on economically. You certainly can't understand the macro world that's happening. And apparently what happened in the U.S., and probably around the world, but in the U.S., these bright, intelligent people running our economic system do not understand the economics of land and the fundamentals of it, could not predict the ups and downs, the boom and bust cycle of land, and operated as if it did not exist, and ran us and the rest of the world over a cliff economically. Now, of course, that's all with the help of Wall Street that did their part in making the land speculation bubble, the real estate bubble, way worse than it ever would have been by inventing all these fancy derivatives and things like that, and sold this stuff all over the world on the premise that land values, the value of houses, the value of real estate never would come down. Which they're really saying, they were saying in essence that land speculation would never end. It would always keep going up. And that is, even for an ordinary, untutored, uneducated lay person, everybody knows that when you're speculating with things, it's going to crash sooner or later. There's always the last buyer. And after the last buyer buys in, the prices don't just stay there. They fall back down to real prices, real values. That's what's happened, destroying all the value of derivatives, wiping out all this equity in the U.S. and everywhere else, just causing havoc in the world. And we're still trying to recover from that here. I don't know if that you folks have actually fallen into this economic hole quite yet, but it's on the way, we suspect. The upshot of it is that, the real core of it is that the value of land and the incomes that can be derived from it, what is known in economics as economic rent. Economic rents apply to the value of land, apply to the value of natural resources and other things. And economic rent is called economic rent because what it really means, the definition of it, is a value created by the community, not by the individual owners of the assets in question.
And a good example of that has just been publicized here in Melbourne, Australia, where a property on the outskirts of Melbourne was farmland in the dying last days of the Brumby Victorian state government. They rezoned that into residential property to help facilitate a sale that occurred. And yeah, some lucky sisters inherited this land. It was bought in 1979 for $920,000, sold just recently for a reported $300 million profit in 2010. So, you know, the vast majority of that $299 million should be going towards funding the schools, the roads, the police, all those sort of things that income taxes are needed for.
Yes, and I did read that story. I was totally astounded. Those two sisters completely hit the jackpot of the unearned income, unearned wealth scam on the planet. And if that story were circulated around the U.S., all of the would-be land speculators who are now in the doldrums would just they would start salivating and dying of envy. Because this is every one of them, and ordinary people, and even including myself. I've sold a couple of pieces of property, not because I'm, you know, a land speculator or a real estate speculator, but if you own a piece of real estate during the uptime, you make money on it, and you know, it's clear to me, obviously, that all of that was a free gift from my society, actually from the whole world. That I clearly did not earn. I pocketed it and went my merry way. And the next time I tried to sell a house, the market had crashed, so I actually couldn't sell it unless I wanted to make a huge loss. So the theory of this stuff was brought home very clearly to me in practice, in my own so-called portfolio of values, which I own, which is not a lot. But you know, everybody who owns a home has got a portfolio of an asset value, and sometimes you win, like these sisters. I mean, those folks have won really big, and all at the expense of everybody else. So, and what's really interesting is to notice that when you change the zoning laws, and that's what you call them in Australia, right?
Hmm.
When a commission sits around and deliberates on whether to change the zoning law, and they decide to change the law with a stroke of a pen, they allowing development for previously undeveloped land, just at that instant, they create land value in the market, in the real world. All of it having nothing to do with what anybody ever did, because it's a value created by what the community does, by the presence of the community, by the existence of the community, of all the people in the community. And when the government does, you know, regulates the land use or unregulates it, upzones a property, creates land value out of by the community. I don't know how else to say it more clearly. And by definition, something that is created by the community belongs to the community. Historically, what we've done is we've given that away. Humanity has given the community created value of land and natural resources away to its so-called owners. And I don't have a beef with any private ownership of land or natural resources. Ownership of land for use, exclusive use, is absolutely necessary. I wouldn't, and none of us are talking about disturbing titles to land or disturbing any property rights. All we're suggesting is the value that's created by all of us should come to us. Simple as that.
And you've been speaking along this line since the 1970s, where I was interested to know you actually educated Alana Hartsock back in the day. And across this time, you must have come across many, many people who just refuse to see that the community's existence creates a competition for land value. And from that, whoever is privileged enough to own that land is delivered a windfall gain. What have been some of the excuses you've heard that, you know, this is rubbish?
Well, I actually haven't been hearing that much lately, but I have in the past. I think the worst, the most devastating thing for me at the time when I heard it, this was 20 plus years ago, a woman came up to me and said that you're trying to steal my land from me. And I was really taken aback. Well, I didn't quite understand the feelings that people have around this. That was part of my education. What people think is that the value that land comes to have, whether they create it or not, they feel, and this is the way all Americans feel, I think, and probably everybody in the English-speaking world, gee, the value went up. It's, you know, because I own the title to the land or to the natural resources, therefore it is mine, as if I created it by myself. So people take it personally, and this is built into our psyches, and especially in America, but I think also must be in Australia. Land speculation and going after this unearned income is so fundamental to our history, is so part and parcel of it, that it is very difficult for most people to, you know, even think outside the box. Our beloved founding fathers, who you guys must hear about ad nauseum, and our vaunted founders of our vaunted freedom, most of them were all land speculators. And many of them speculated with continental dollars after our revolution. So speculation in one kind or another is really part and parcel of the American economic scene. And really, we inherited that from Britain, and the entire English-speaking world inherited that. The English-speaking world especially seems to be very avid at collecting unearned incomes and getting this something for nothing business, but the rest of the world has learned it as well. India, China, Latin America, everybody, it's really everywhere now. And the wealthy are the ones who have been collecting this and concentrating it in ownership for a couple of centuries now. And they're very good at it. And they've really won the game.
How does this parallel to slavery? You know, there was a civil war in America over the concerns of injustice upon African Americans with their bondage.
Well, I think that's exactly the case. The economics of slavery, I think, are exactly the same as the economics of land. If you own a piece of land and you cash in on its, either charge the land rent for it, that's an unearned income to you because somebody else created that value.
So if the rent your house has gone up 10% in the last couple of years, what has a landowner done to really deserve that? And so that higher rent you're paying really are invisible chains around your opportunity and your freedoms.
Exactly. Unless the landowner, unless the property owner has made an improvement that you can see on the property, put, you know, add in a new room or whatever. He has not done anything. He or she has not done anything to earn the increased rent that they charge. And that's that. So essentially, every time you get one of those kind of rent increases without something that the landlord has actually done to improve the improvement on the land, you can bet that is, he's just charging an increased cost of the land. So I say that slavery because if you own slaves, now I think I have some forebears who own some slaves, and how that works is if you own a slave, what you're buying is you're buying the right to collect the value of the slave's labor. And that is a completely unearned income because for the same reason that collecting land rent is unearned, because somebody else is creating that value. So the profits from owning slaves and the profits from owning land are exactly the same. The profit from that a private owner of land gets from charging land rent is the same in economic terms as the profits that a slave owner gets by, you know, gathering in the results of the labor of a slave. The thing that's exactly the same in both cases is that somebody else beside the owner of the land or the slave creates the value, but the owner gets to have the value. And by definition, that means that's unearned to him. So slavery created huge unearned incomes. Land ownership, natural resource ownerships, create huge unearned incomes, and that's about 25 to 30% of national and world GNP. So in the U.S., it's something like $3 to $4 trillion of unearned income. What's the Australian GNP? 25 to 30% of that is most likely an unearned income.
Well, that's certainly right. Terry Dwyer deducted that in his classical components of GDP graph back in 2001, I think. So that was it. 30% is the most thorough study in the world on the role of economic rent. And it, in 1911, capital and labor got 85% of the share of our total output of our GDP. And in today's times, they're battling to get barely 40% because taxes are chasing so many problems. They're expanding the tax base because there are all these issues created because of the privatization of, yeah, the people's purse, this economic rent we talk about.
So non-landowners pay twice. They pay rent for land and they pay the taxes to pay for the services, all of which make land more valuable. You know, how it can't get much clearer. And when I talk to people, people who don't know about economics very much, anybody with an open mind, pretty much gets the point. Especially these days, when I talk to people, there's now an openness here that, the old explanations and the old certainties and the old opinions really don't work anymore for most people. So there's a hearing for these ideas here.
Because we really feel like we're beating our head against the wall. We're trying to get people to understand that the earth will always become more valuable. And here in Australia, we've suffered a tragic coup with our Prime Minister Kevin Rudd being ousted in mid-year. And with the WikiLeaks phenomena unveiling the fact that the up-and-coming Mark Abib within the ruling party's machinations was reporting to the US government some 6 months before the coup that there was the real possibility of a change of leadership due to this mining tax threat. And it was all revolving around the fact that we had this Henry tax review released in May this year that was discussing the fact that we should be capturing upwards of 40% of the economic rent from the land, give or take quite a few loopholes. But from this point on, now we're facing, and I'm just trying to spell out why people are so reticent to understand this story. We now have the mining magnate, heiress Gina Rinehart, taking a seat on one of our most popular TV stations. So she's now a director on one of our most popular TV stations and no doubt will try and control some of the content that goes to air. And of course, this station pretty well is a commercial station and doesn't have much critical analysis. But still, the fact that she's assuming this position within the media sort of reflects how the privileged are entrenching their position and how they always have over the ages.
Yes, I'd say it's just another chapter in this long, sad, and tragic history of the privatization of the earth, making everybody, a tenant, having to pay premium for access to their own planet. It's absurd on its face, and how it is that more people don't just pick this up and cry out. It's really a mystery to me. It's been a mystery to the whole 37 or 38 years that I've been involved in understanding this. It's like, wait a minute, where are people's heads with this? So the folks who understand this have been very diligent in going after this. Why not? If you can get something for nothing, you go for it. This has funded all of their historical then monopolization of capital to the extent that capital is monopolized. This allows that to be done. And they've been very successful in getting the rest of us to pay the taxes for all of these public services that make the assets in their hands more valuable. It's really an astounding scenario on this planet.
We're talking to Wendell Fitzgerald. Wendell Fitzgerald, based in California, about the value of the earth.
We often criticize the wealthy, but geonomics makes some interesting distinctions between wealth and privilege. Can you tell us how wealth is actually created?
Simply enough, it's as the classical economists said originally, It's people, labor, using tools, capital, and the basic idea of capital is the tools of production on land. Everything takes place on land. Nothing does not take place on land. So it's land, labor, capital, and it's labor using its, you know, hands, physical and strength and mental abilities using tools. And all that's ever happened over the ages is that our tools have gotten more sophisticated. And those two, labor and capital, human beings and tools, have the use of that creates all the wealth that we have. Of course, all that production takes place on land, and the raw materials for all of that come from the land, come from the earth. So, and all we've ever done is just gotten more sophisticated in how we, in the resources that we draw upon in our production. But it, I say that, you know, how I speak about it is that there's a real economy where people are actually producing real goods and real services that did not exist before. That's where value, that's wealth, when there's more goods and services that didn't exist before. And a lot of people think, and a lot of people here in this country, Alan Greenspan, a guy in our Federal Reserve System, and others were saying, well, people's wealth is increasing because the value of their real estate is going up. And what that really meant is that the value of land was going up. And these guys were saying, oh, no, this means that everybody's more wealthy. They have more wealth in their hands, in their portfolios. And the truth of that, if they'd understood the proper definition of wealth, real wealth is stuff that's produced by effort of labor and use of tools, capital, to produce something of value that people want that did not exist before. So saying that the increased value of land or of increased value of natural resources, like this $300 million that these sisters have gotten, that's not wealth. That is, yes, it's denominated in dollars. There's nothing new. The land was never produced, and its increased value does not have anything to do with the production of real wealth. All that reflects is that there are more people, and they're willing to pay more for an existing asset, an existing piece of land. That's the distinction. Wealth is stuff that's really is produced in the real economy by people working using all the various tools that we have. One of the clearest examples of this so-called wealth of land value came about when the speculative value of land peaked and then dropped, and overnight this so-called wealth that existed in people's portfolios disappeared. Real wealth does not disappear. You know, real wealth is a house, is an apartment, is a factory, is a machine, is computers, is picks and shovels, and, you know, everything that you use to do stuff. That stuff doesn't go away, but this value of the speculative value of land, it's a whole other beast. And when it disappears, that's when people find out that there's something going on here we don't understand.
So when they call it a credit crisis, what should they really call it?
Oh, geez, that's a good question. I don't know. the credit crisis was brought on by people being stampeded into borrowing money to buy a house. That was one part of it, but also people stampeding into the real estate market just to buy for profit, ultimately, to flip houses, to ultimately, you know, in a couple of years, sell for a profit. And all of that was done here, and I'm sure everywhere else, by borrowing. And that was by far the largest chunk of the credit and the borrowing that was done. And that's in addition to the, you know, credit card, you know, people get into a credit crisis by using credit cards. But the biggest credit that's extended and the biggest borrowing thing that goes on is the borrowing of money from our banks, your banks, for purchase of land. What's really interesting, as the community created value of land goes up, people have to borrow more and more from the banks. The banks love it. In this country, since we create essentially the world's money, we can just extend credit almost infinitely, as our buddy Michael Hudson has pointed out. And finally, even that, even though there was plenty of money sloshing around and interest rates were low, it finally got to a place where even that would not keep the land speculation ball rolling. And what's really fascinating to view it from this vantage point is that these guys at the top apparently had no idea that this was going to happen. Alan Greenspan is saying he had no idea, and he was in charge. And everybody, you know, listened to this great genius, and the king has no clothes. The guy didn't know what he was talking about. What's interesting is that Alan Greenspan came from, he was originally an Ayn Rand libertarian. And the Ayn Rand libertarians, much to my surprise recently, I discovered that they're saying that there is no such thing as community. And when I talk about the community created value of land, they say, you don't know what, they're saying to me that I don't know what I'm talking about. Because by definition, there is no community, and therefore there can be no community created value. And the truth of it is that land value is the best evidence there is of the existence of community, measured in dollars and cents. Community is kind of an abstraction, but you darn well know that community exists because of the value of land and natural resources that aren't otherwise produced by anything anybody does.
And I suppose that's reflected in maybe a hipster-type community where everyone wants to live near the cool cafe and the effective public transport system and yep. Lots of natural parks and those sort of things. And so the land values in those areas are higher than the communities where there are no places to congregate and have fun.
Exactly, exactly. People are willing to pay more for nice locations. And nice locations are defined by, most of them are defined by what's available to be done. Yeah, the nice coffee shops, the nice theaters, the nice streets, and all the public conveniences, the transportation and the parks and all of that. So it's really crystal clear. And the economists from the beginning, the earliest economists recognize they recognize this. Adam Smith talks about economic rent. You can go on Wikipedia, anybody can go on in a short amount of time. You can read about economic rent, which is the value created by the community. And essentially no economist really argues with this concept of economic rent. They understand that value is created by the community. And most of them will agree that it's the best source of public revenue. I never hear anybody, maybe there are some economists who will argue against it, but you would be a fool if you're a professional economist to argue that economic rent is anything other than community created, because it's clearly the case. I think the problem with economists and others who know about it, don't talk about it, because there's no constituency for it. If there was a constituency saying we want to hear more about this, or we want to use this as a source of revenue, these guys would speak up. And we're perhaps coming into a time, I'm hoping, soon in this country where people are going to be coming aware, because people are asking the question, what in the heck happened? What do we do about this?
What do we do? What do we do? Well, in a week where the Australian government's banking reforms again ripped off the little man, where the OECD report coming out talking about, yes, the need to tax land so we keep a lid on these property bubbles, when there's 20 million vacant homes around China. It's a mad, mad world in this era of economic two-dimensionalism. So let's hope more people can tune into these key topics, earthsharing.org.au, and stay tuned, podcasters, for an extended interview with Wendell. And for the rest of us, hang on, because the boldness are here. Yay! All right, thanks for listening. The Renegade Economist will see you soon.
One of the things that's happening in California is that one of our colleagues has written what they call a citizen initiative, and it's got it approved to, it's been run through the, I guess the Secretary of State gets to approve all of these initiatives. Now, in order for it to get on the ballot, it has to receive something like 700 or 800,000 signatures. And we're hoping to mount a campaign starting in early 2012, because it takes quite a bit of planning and some money to get something on the ballot like this. If you go to prospercalifornia.com, you can see this fellow's, his name is Frank Walker, who has written this up. He's quite brilliant. And he's proposing overnight, in one fell swoop, a shift of tax, essentially all taxation in California onto land values, and the elimination of the state income tax, the state sales tax, the state and the county property taxes on all improvements. So he's not, a lot of us Georgians think, well, maybe we should do this a little bit at a time, but he's succeeded in drafting a brilliant piece of legislation. If it were passed, it would be a good piece of legislation to shift the tax all at once. Now, whether that works or not, it's going to be an incredible opportunity for education in California. And as you probably know, California is virtually bankrupt, and people are casting around for how to cut the budget by cutting services. And our new governor, Jerry Brown, is, I don't envy his position. He's going to, and I don't think he's going to promote this idea himself. I think he understands it, but not probably well enough. So we've got a couple more years of real difficult times for public funding of services in California. And given that we're such a huge economy, it's one, like it was at one point, the fifth or seventh largest economy just by itself. This is really a disaster for not only for California, but for this country and for the world, to have its economic, the backbone, its government essentially become powerless and fall apart. And essentially, there's nobody really talking about it except us talking about, why don't we do this kind of taxation? It will solve the problem.
I couldn't believe that your oil companies aren't paying any severance tax, any royalties on the oil they're pulling out of the ground. Similar sort of destructive tax mechanisms occur in the housing market with Proposition 13 that we've been educating some of our listeners to over here, but really you guys are an economic basket case when it comes to taxation.
That's right. And even, so here's the... Texas in this country is very conservative, and you would think opposed to these ideas, but Texas taxes the heck out of its oil, way beyond anything California. California actually does apparently tax some of its of the value of the community credit value of oil, but certainly not by the ordinary method of royalty payments. Texas it apparently does fiscally very well, because they do tax their oil. And the other example, of course, you probably noted to your listeners, is Alaska, that has this permanent fund out of which everybody in the state, every citizen, man, woman, and child, gets a dividend. And I guess it's been averaging about $1,500 every year. Can you imagine for a family of four, how much is that? It's about $6,000. What an enormous difference that makes to a family. And that, when you really look at it from our point of view, everybody's earned that income. It's not a welfare. It's not a gift of something that wasn't there. This is a value that ordinary citizens create, and Alaska has seen fit to actually pay individual citizens this dividend, and it's sort of like saying, "Gee, thank you for being one of our citizens. Here's a nice payment to you for the value that you've given to the state and to the resources of this state." That could be done in every state. Every state's got maybe not the huge resources that Alaska does, but every state's got some billions and billions of dollars worth of some natural resource. Obviously, Texas does. Obviously, California does. So for California oil companies not to pay essentially anything, no royalties, into the public coffer is another stupefying, just unbelievable oversight of governance in this state. That, again, unfortunately, there's not enough public constituency to demand that it be done. So these guys, the big oil companies, the big resource companies, the big real estate companies, essentially have won over the centuries and over the decades, have really won. They've won the battle. They've called something that's black, they've called it white, and everybody believes it. It's really astounding. And I think, however, there will come a time, there is coming a time, when people are going to wake up and just be able to see what is utterly simple. When I got onto this idea, it was all that had to be said was to, it just had to be described to me, and the light went on for me. And I suppose that happened. It was not that I'm, you know, any more intelligent than anybody. It was just I was ready to hear it. And of course, it grabbed my attention that a long time ago, and I haven't been able to forget it since.
So, how is your coffee table analysis going? I remember when we met in San Francisco a couple of years ago, you were saying how every time you went into a coffee shop, you would always hear some sort of cafe chatter about property and how much money people were making and so forth. Yeah. What has your radar been picking up recently?
Well, there's certainly no more chat about real estate investment. None. That's all done for now. So what am I hearing? I guess I'm hearing other laments about difficulties with employment. Times are a bit tough. So that's what I'm hearing. Nobody is talking in glowing terms about that I was hearing during the bust or the boom cycle. I mean, everybody. I mean, even people who weren't able to engage in it, they were talking about it. Wow, what a wonder this was. Everybody knew somebody who was making money doing this, and it's real silent on that score. What's unfortunate in my opinion is, well, what happened to all the people who used to be talking about this? Why aren't they talking about what happened? Well, how they're talking about it is they're lamenting their fate. Many people have lost their jobs, or if they're business owners, they're, you know, it's a tough go.
And what about the Obama tax cuts and the extension of the Bush tax cuts for another 2 years? How's that going down with the people on the street?
Where I live in Ashland, Oregon, which is a pretty liberal place, it's not going down at all. But if you listen to the news, of course, it's all manufactured, I think, and and apparently it looks like the if you listen to that, the vast majority of Americans think this is a great idea. Well, the conservative party here, the Republicans, think that they have won a landslide victory. That's how they're playing it, and this is how the media is reporting it, and from what little I see of it, again, this is something really astounding. This was something that was entirely unexpected here. That to have told people 2 years ago that Obama would do this, would agree to the extension of the tax cut for the wealthy, it would have been, nobody would have believed you. Not a person, because we all expected that, you know, when the time comes for this to end, that he would have supported the end of it, regardless of any pushback from the conservatives party. Republicans. So it's really kind of unbelievable for liberals and progressives and ordinary Democrats. And on the other hand, I'm still a fan of Obama. I really like the guy. I'm hoping in the next 2 years that he will bear out the confidence that we had in him and the good thoughts we had. I think his job is incredibly difficult. And it's getting to the edge of why is he not pushing even a little bit? So his, you know, when you listen to his talk, thinking and talking about this, it sort of makes sense. You know, he doesn't want to have a fight that is going to, in the short run, harm people, because you can't, now that the Republicans control the House of Congress, the House of Representatives, there's hardly anything that can be passed, and the Senate is in this country is all messed up with this 60% rule. So it's really sort of like government is stymied.
What's the 60% rule?
In the Senate, if you want to filibuster, in other words, to just say I object to anything going on until to impose a filibuster. As long as you've got the floor, you can prevent anything from going on, and people have done this, and have and the Republicans have done it many times in the past. I mean, all the way through history, certainly up into the current times. Democrats have done it some as well, but mostly the Republicans have done this. But the point is that if you if any member gets up in the Senate and says I object to what's going on and I call a filibuster, that person can prevent anything else from going on unless the Senate votes 60%, which is 60 members because there are 100 members in the Senate. If 60 members can vote that to close the filibuster cannot be broken. So any getting anything done in our Senate requires not a majority, but 60%. And the Republicans have closed ranks on this. Virtually none of their members have broken rank ever in the last couple of years to allow things to go forward. So this yeah. have such incredible say over pretty much everything. It's really brought everything to a halt in terms of any kind of progress that, that we progressives, that we liberals think should be done. They've stymied it. So how long that's going to go on, who knows? Maybe it'll stop when they finally take control of the Senate. But, you know, I think that actually the kind of the government here, maybe elsewhere, has become irrelevant. The government can actually not deliver on what's needed. And maybe that will change in future years, but right now, it's really very much in a quagmire. So it sort of sounds like what's happening in Australia. You know, the fact that the mining interests have stymied any kind of taxation on the economic rent of their assets. It's like, wow. So how do we actually do any of this? How do we actually get anything done for the good of all people? Doesn't look like it's right now very much possible to do through our governments. I'm not suggesting that we have some other kind of revolution. I think revolutions are incredibly chancy, and they do a lot of, you know, of collateral damage, just like any kind of war does. I'm banking on the hearts of people, I'm kind of a woo guy. I like this idea of the Mayan calendar business of 2012. And I think what I'm seeing is that the consciousness of people is changing. People are transforming a lot. Pretty much everybody I know is going through one thing or the other and waking up in some way. And I think that this is probably what will be the only way for us, for, you know, the progressive agendas, for heartfelt agendas to progress in the world. It has to come from the people. We are the government here, and I'm assuming that the people are the sovereign in Australia. Isn't that correct?
No, the Queen is.
The Queen, I forgot about the Queen. Oh, well. Yeah, but she's sort of, yeah, okay, I hear what you're saying. Well, we the people here are the sovereigns, but it's really the very powerful who have got control of the levers of government. So when people wake up, when the ideas whose time has come actually come, there's really no stopping them. So I think there's a lot of things in the works that will, and it might have to take a miracle or look like a miracle. But I don't think it's going to be done by the ordinary processes of government. So anyway, I guess I'm saying that prayer is good. Hope is good, and I never pass up an opportunity to talk to people, to buttonhole them. Poor people, I've been lambasting them with this stuff every time I ever had a chance for the last 37 years, and I think it's actually paid off a bit. People are in these times are saying, Wendell, I remember this guy Wendell. You've been talking about this for a long time, and now it seems to make sense. So the seeds are that have been planted by all of us who understand this, I think, are starting to take root and grow. At least that's my hope.
Do you see much of that going on within the environmental movement? Are they who are the people who understand this, who seem to grasp it better? Would it be business types or your traditional lefties or greenies? What would it be?
The lefties, the kind of hard lefties, don't seem to be interested whatsoever. Although, you know, the first thing on the Communist Manifesto was the socialization of economic rent. So the socialists and the really hard lefties, we have made no headway with. I guess the people who are very clear about it very fast are the business people and small business people that I run into. They understand the economics of how things work. And most of the people who I know these days the small business people have to rent their facilities. And so when I talk about the economics of land, the economics of rent, they get it in a heartbeat. And because they've been subject to rent increases all along. And when I say, well, gee, this looks like virtual slavery, they say, that's exactly how we feel. You know, we work hard, we improve our business, you know, we do all the right things to get more business, make a bit more money, and then the rent goes up. Say, well, so the point there is, the question is, what's the point? You know, you work harder, work smarter, work faster, and stay in the same place. So there's tons of business, small business people, shopkeeping type people in particular, who they understand this. And anytime I ever get a chance to talk to one of them, they're clear. And they may be pretty conservative otherwise, but they would agree that, gee, taxing landlords, taking the land rent to pay for public services and eliminating the taxes that otherwise fall on small businesses, they are all for that.
Wendell, any last parting commentary? How do you survive watching the news these days? Do you beat your head against the wall, or can you join the dots between all these different issues through this role of the ever-increasing value of the earth and its licensed monopolies?
Well, what I, you know, to tell you the truth, I don't look at the news anymore. I follow it just to check in with it, and I can do that on my computer and on occasion. I don't have a television working in my place right now, and part of the reason for that is it's so toxic. So too much looking at television and listening to the news is not good for your health. And what I've recently been hearing is that there's a thing called the negative bias. Have you heard this phrase?
No.
Humanity has what is called a negative bias, which appears in, you know, you talk to most people, who conspiracy theorists and ordinary people, and you listen to the news, it's all negative. And the reason for this is that over the millions of years of our evolution, we have had, you know, we've had to look out for danger. So it's built into our DNA. And it makes sense. You know, if there's danger in the world, you better be aware of it. The truth of it is now is that this negative bias exists whether or not there is a real threat in the environment. Our business of, you know, fighting against the war on terror, in my opinion, is a very large percentage of that is bogus. There isn't really a terror threat. Not that there isn't some, but the bias, the knee-jerk bias of everything is going to hell, everything is falling apart, the world's going to collapse, the governments are going to collapse. None of that is true. The truth is, and I've been talking to a guy, you may hear more of him in the future, his name is Timothy Nobles, and he will have a book out called Growing Up as a Species. But he hasn't published it yet. But what the idea is, and it's not absolutely new with him, because he's done a lot of research. There's tons of people, Lester Brown, Jeffrey Sachs, to name a few, who have been saying for years that humanity has enough wealth, enough know-how, enough intelligence, and enough solutions in hand, including the ones we're talking about, to solve all of our problems, all of them, right now. And when you listen to the case he makes, I knew this just from the very fact of being understanding this economics. I have thought all these years, anytime humanity wanted to turn around the problems and solve them, we could anytime we wanted to. And there is an enormous amount of research that proves that this is so, without even understanding the economics that we're talking about, without even understanding that how you would fund this. There's so much wealth in the world, so much that is working really well, just taking even a little bit of it. You know, most of these guys are talking, well, let's just take a little tiny percentage of the Forex transactions that occur every day. You know, less than 1% of that would fund ending the worst, most of poverty, certainly the worst aspects of poverty. Nobody would ever starve to death again. And we could do that in a heartbeat. So the truth of life here is that in an instant, we could turn this around. We have the resources. And this is now the positive bias. It's not even a bias. It's just the truth of the matter. It's all of these people crying wolf, all of these people crying, saying that the thing is going to collapse. Sure, there's lots of dark forces in the world and lots of problems, but we have right now in our hands, even if we don't do this wonderful thing that we're talking about, if we would tax the economic rent of the world, the fund would be so huge. But we don't even need to do that to solve the really hard problems right now.
Do you really believe that? Because if we did give free food out to everyone, sure, there would be no one would be hungry. But, of course, that would mean that the price of land would be bid up. And so, again, the economic slavery would continue. And, you know, we've seen over US $1 trillion in foreign aid be pummeled into these developing countries, and they've, in fact, gone backwards.
Absolutely. So I'm having a conversation with this fellow who – He's done huge research on the existing thought and literature, and I've done is pointed out to him, say, Timothy, by the way, do you understand what happens, exactly the point you've just made, when you give aid to these countries, what happens to land value? And he sat there and thought for a second. It didn't take very long for him, oh dear, it all goes up. Well, if you know, and the fact that the land and the natural resources are in the hands of a relative few, gee, it enriches those few at the top. Oh, so he got the point. And so in his book, he's going to talk about these ideas as part of this is how you implement it. And I was saying to him, well, we have the capacity to do this, but boy, if you did it without doing what we're saying, without taxing land values to fund this effort, it will make things worse. I think he's got that, and I think there's a couple of other authors who I've talked to through other connections that I have, that these guys are getting this. So I think that you're going to see books out on the market where this is being said, and people like Lester Brown and Jeffrey Sachs, I don't know that they actually understand this. This is too really simple. When it starts to be getting a hearing, they will have to come on board, and when they do, They will influence millions of people, because millions of people are listening to them and reading them and liking what they're saying. And all they have to do is, you know, add a little chapter. Hey, tax land values to fund this for this reason and that reason. And people, it could come on very quickly.
Wendell Fitzgerald, it has been fantastic to yet again have you on the show, winding your way through so many topics. Thanks, Wendell Fitzgerald.
My pleasure. Thank you, Carl.